as we enter into your word, we pray that you would give us eyes to see and ears to hear your truth, that our hearts would be open to be transformed more into the image of your Son, that as we leave from here, we might be your servants in the world. I don't know about all of you, but for me, I often have forgotten how great the God we serve is. And I've come to points in my life that I've been so wrapped up in what's going on with me in the here and now that I forget about the God that I worship and adore with everything, or I'm supposed to at least. And I forget how big he is, how great he is, and I can stand to have a little bit of a reminder of this God we claim to serve. I think our passages this morning, both from Genesis and from Psalm 27 and from Philippians, all teach us and help us to remember how great and big the God we serve is. And so we come this morning to these passages wanting to seek guidance, to have this kind of reminder so that we might be filled up with the remembrance of God's greatness and leave here ready to serve that great God with reckless abandon. So the first thing I think we see comes from Genesis chapter 15, and that is that God is bigger than our expectations. God is much greater than anything you could ever expect of God to be. God is huge. It is so much greater than our little perspectives. Abraham and Sarah forgot this. And they had a great expectation. Their expectation was that they would produce an heir. It was the expectation, really, of any married couple in the times that they lived in tribal culture, is to produce an heir, because to produce an heir is to keep your legacy, your lineage, alive in the land. If you don't produce an heir, then your stuff will just kind of get dispersed and disappear. And if all that you have built as a part of your legacy and a part of the memory of who you are will be lost. So if they don't have an heir, there's threat that their work on this earth will be for naught. And God comes to Abraham in a dream, and Abraham's first thoughts to him was, well, but I expected to have an heir by this point, and I don't have an heir, so I have to give it to one of my servants as my heir. I have to adopt someone not from my household as my heir. And God makes him a promise. God says, no, you will have an heir. I will give you an heir. The problem with their expectation is that they didn't trust God to do it as God wanted, so they began to get older. How many of you guys know this story from Genesis, right? They begin to get a little older, and Abraham is getting into his 90s, and Sarah's getting up there too, and they still don't have a son, someone that they could pass all of their stuff on to. And they think, well, you know, maybe God needs our help. Maybe it's that God needs us to kind of work a little bit here too with him. And so Sarah gives over her servant to Abraham to produce an heir for her and him. And they produce Ishmael, right? And so they give over this idea, this expectation they have, to their own control, to their own ideas. And then God comes back to them, and what does he say? That's not what I promised you. I promised that you would have a son. If you would be faithful and patient and wait on me, I will give you a son. And at that point, Abraham and Sarah both laugh because of how old they are and how impossible it seems that God might do this. So they put these expectations on God, and not only have they put these expectations on God, they have tried to control the situation that their expectations might be fulfilled, not in the way God designed it to be fulfilled, but in the way they designed it to be fulfilled. This is the problem with expectations. I got married very, very young. I was 21 when I got married. But I got married after two of my best friends got married at the age of 19. And I was able to witness their marriages as I was a young married man myself. And these two guys, neither of them were really Christian, and one of them I was really spending a lot of time with to try and help him come to know the Lord. And I was working at a church nearby where he and his wife lived after they'd been married 4 or 5 years. And their marriage was falling apart. And I was regularly meeting with both of them, counseling them, trying to help them save their vows to each other that they had made, that they could make their marriage work. As I did this, I began to notice something that was a poison in their marriage, and really what it was expectation. They had expectations of each other that they didn't voice, that were unrealistic, and that they judged the other person based on. And these expectations began to build up into frustrations, and the frustrations built up into bitterness and anger, and then eventually hatred, and then they got a divorce. And as my wife and I discussed and talked about this, watching their marriage dissolve, we realized these expectations that they had in their marriage were poisonous. And so we decided, we made a goal with each other that we would have very low expectations for each other. We would keep our expectations as base as possible. You're going to be faithful with me, right? Yes. You're going to be faithful with me? Yes. Okay, that's good. But what we decided instead, and it's advice I give every single couple that I've ever officiated in their wedding, that I've done premarital counseling with, and that is that if you are going into this marriage, your expectations should be as low for the other person as possible and should be as high for yourself as possible. The expectation should not be on the other person, but the expectation should be on you, that you would perform what your duty is in the relationship, in the covenant that you're making. In that way, if your expectation is only on yourself and your actions towards the other, then you can only walk away disappointed when those expectations aren't fulfilled in who? Yourself. And then that should lead you to try and grow and try better the next time. And so this is a goal my wife and I have made, and we try to learn, but it very much applies, I think, to our relationship with God. God has given us much to promise us, and it has given us much to hope for. And yet how God accomplishes those things are radically different than our expectations almost always are. I can tell you right now, about 6 months ago, I never would have thought I would have been standing here preaching to you. God's plans are so much greater, so much bigger than any expectation you could ever give, and sometimes are lived out in ways that you can't even fathom. So when you put that expectations on God that are your expectations, what begins to happen is you replace God in the seat of judgment and you become God's judge. You become the one sitting in judgment of God and saying, why haven't you done this, God? And you begin to harbor bitterness and anger and hatred in your heart towards God because he isn't doing it the way you assumed or desired for him to do it. This is a roadmap to a bad relationship. So if we recognize that God is so much greater than any expectation we could ever have, and we begin to lay down our expectations and trust in the one who has given us all these promises, then you will grow in your relationship with God. Because God is so much greater than any expectation we can have. Our second passage from Psalm 27, which we sung in the band, did such a great job with, teaches us, I think, that God is greater, God is bigger than any troubles we could ever have. God is so much greater than anything that could possibly stand in your way, be an obstacle, and do anything to cause you harm. God is greater than those things. Except for that, it doesn't feel that way, does it? How many of you have ever had anything bad happen to you, ever? You can raise your hands. It's okay. This is an interactive service. This is a show. All of us should have been raising our hands. Every one of us has had something that we didn't like happen to us. It was unfair. It was maybe even unjust. And yet God is greater than that. God is bigger than that. But in the moment, it feels so much like is so much bigger than God. When we get in the face of it, when we get in the midst of it, it feels like it's an impossible thing to overcome. How could God possibly take this out, or how could God possibly use this horrendous event for his glory? we lose sight of the grandeur of God. David, who wrote the Psalm 27, knew this all well. If you don't know David's story, David was just a shepherd boy. He was one of the youngest in his family of a bunch of big, strapping young men. And he was this kind of ruddy runt of a boy who was sent off to shepherd while they were all at war for the king. And yet God called him and anointed him to be king. Great thing, right? Wonderful thing. Except that the king that he served as a harpist and various other things in a way that, that only David could, began to turn on him. The man who he admired, the man who he saw as a mentor, the man who he saw almost like a father, began to hunt him down and attempt to kill him. And though David had at many times not only the right, but had the opportunity to exact revenge on Saul, David did not. David withheld his hand and allowed Saul to act unjustly to him, and he acted with justice and mercy toward Saul. That's not the end of David's problems. David becomes king after Saul dies, and David continues to have problems. Some of the problems might have been self-made. Other problems were problems that came upon him, many family problems. At one point, his oldest son doesn't like the fact that God has told David that Solomon, his younger son, will be his heir and his appointee to the throne as king. And so he rebels against David, overthrows David's kingdom, and puts David in exile. Can you imagine that? Some of you may not have to imagine that. Some of you maybe have had your children treat you that poorly. Much David's heart must have broke. And yet in the midst of these things, David never turned his back on God. David understood that even in these trials and tribulations, even in the trouble, even in the opposition that he faced on a regular basis, that the God that he served was so much greater than that. And it always allowed him to have perspective to see those problems through God's eyes and not his own. So we see in Psalm 27, he says, whom shall I fear? Who can be against me if my God is for me? He says, instead, one thing I ask of you, Lord, one thing I will seek is to dwell in your house forever. Can you imagine crying that out when you had so much tribulation going on in your life, so much horrible things happening to you, that you would cry that cry of faithfulness out to God and say, the only thing I want is to be in your house forever. Forget all of this that's going on. Lord, I just want you. God is so much greater than our troubles, and oftentimes it's our troubles which teaches us how great God is. It's the troubles in our life that drive us back to God when we've become too self-reliant. When we have forgotten how great God is, God allows sometimes for us, like Israel had over and over again, a tribulation that would remind them that He is their Lord. They are not their own lords. Sometimes our troubles are designed to draw us back. But even if that's not the case, even if it's a trouble that is just upon us unfairly, unjustly, I can guarantee you that there is a God working for you to turn it that way, to bring you to the realization that He is your Lord, that you would turn to Him and seek Him with everything in your life. Because God is so much greater than any trouble you could ever have. The third thing I think we learned from passage in Philippians is that God is even greater than not just our troubles, but the entire world. That includes everything. That includes even the blessings, even the good things, even the things that we enjoy. God is greater than those things. Because if you really began to grasp the gospel and grasp what Scripture is telling us about who God is and who God has been to us, you'll begin to see that there is no blessing that compares to Christ. The true blessing, the greatest blessing, The blessing above all blessings is being restored through a relationship with God in Jesus Christ. God is bigger than this world. God is bigger than anything we could possibly imagine. And Paul says it this way in the Philippians passage. Paul says that you are not citizens of this earth. You are citizens of heaven. This is very significant because of the people that he's writing to. He's writing to a Roman colony in a Greek town. That might not make sense to you, except for that Greece had once been the top dogs around before Rome rose up. And so the Greek people had a great pride in who they were, and they saw the Romans as invaders. And so the true citizens of Philippi, this Roman colony in a Greek town, had to put their trust in one thing. What was that one thing? No. The Christians put their hope in Jesus Christ, but the citizens of Philippi put their hope in Rome and in Caesar. Because if the barbaric tribes from the north or somebody else came to invade that city, if somebody came in, they had only one shot to be saved, and that was to call upon the might, the power of Caesar in Rome, that they might come and rescue them and restore order in Philippi, just like it was in Rome. And so being a citizen of Rome in Philippi was incredibly important. It didn't mean that they were not living in a land that was very foreign to them, it was odd, that was filled with people who might want to kill them, but it meant that they had the security and the safety of trusting in the power of Rome behind them. So when Paul says, you are citizens of heaven, he's not saying that your option here on earth is just to escape the world because the world's evil, so just leave it alone. We go to the side. He's saying that as you live in the world, but not of the world, trust and know that the power of everything in heaven, of the God who created everything that you see, is behind you. That there is nothing greater than God. There is nothing that can overcome God in your life. You have the greatest King who can rescue you from anything and who can bless you with far greater things than this world can. So seek not the things of this world, but seek Christ, where your true citizenship lies. He says it in Philippians like this, or in Colossians, he says it like this. He says, do not seek the things of this world, but seek the things that are above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. So as you live in this world, it is not your call to escape from the world, to come into a building once a week and hear a message and sing some songs and then go back out into the world and forget all that was in here. As you live in the world, you are called to be an ambassador of Christ, to seek not the things of the world, to seek not material gain, to seek not justice for yourself, to seek not pleasure and all these things that the world tells you that you should seek, but instead to seek one thing, Christ. Desire after him. Seek after him. And as you do, you'll become his servant, his colonist on this earth, making heaven here as it is in heaven. Because God is so much bigger than anything this world can offer you. If we would trust in him and seek him, and know that he is good, and know that he'll use us